dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the home front issues in that war at the moment, of course, is the assault we have been under as a nation now for, the better part of a year from what I think is best described as the Chinese Communist Party virus. The CCP virus and now pandemic has been afflicting our country in horrible and dramatic ways, most, of course, ominously and frighteningly through the loss of our people, something on the order of 160,000 of them who have died. But the trauma to the country as a whole, to the population that fears death or just terrible suffering, the economy that has been badly disrupted, and even to some extent our national security, which has been degraded by the CCP virus, is unfortunately not just a public health emergency any longer. It is a national trauma that must be corrected. I'm proud to say that a friend of mine is doing something about that. His name is Andrew Whitney. He has been working for months now with a company called Phoenix Biotechnology on a remarkable product that could just be a cure to COVID-19, as it's known formally. I'm very pleased to have Andrew Whitney with us. He is the executive chairman of this company. He is the driving force behind the effort to both bring this product to market. It's known as Oleandrin. And to talk a little bit about it and to explain why it is being subjected to such serious abuse at the moment, very proud to welcome for the first time to these microphones, Andrew Whitney. It's good to have you with us, sir. Thank you for taking a few minutes to talk about what's going on and why it is of such remarkable importance to all of us.
Hello, Frank. It's wonderful to be on the show. Terrific to talk to you. I should state very clearly at the outset that this is a tremendous team at the company Phoenix Biotechnology, and much, much smarter guys than I when it comes to phenomenal research scientists. I happen to be the business guy. My background is in private equity, investing in technology-driven businesses. I did, at the outset of my career, I think at one point I wanted to be a physician back when I used to live in England before I became an American 20 years ago. But a long time ago, as a kid growing up in England, so I went off down that kind of what you would call the pre-med track. Then changed direction and realized that a career in business was probably better suited to me. So I invest in and grow technology-driven companies these days, and I try to identify things that I think are really going to move the ball up the field. This obviously was of paramount importance given the scale of the problem we're all facing here. So it's been a tremendous privilege to find myself in this situation. I consider it highly providential to be asked to help this wonderful company bring something tremendously valuable to market and to work with the great people within the company to do that.
So among the companies you've grown over the years have been biotech companies, so this isn't your first rodeo in this particular space. But it is an extraordinary story of a company that has been beavering away on some extraordinary, intellectual property, I guess you might call it. Tell us about it and what has happened in the past 6 or so months since you got involved with the company to bring it to the forefront of possible solutions to the COVID-19 nightmare.
Well, the story is a remarkable one, Frank. This is a company that for over a quarter of a century, it just sounds so remarkable like that, but for more than 25 years, this company has been researching a particular molecule called oleandrin, which is a tiny subset of a plant called Nerium oleander. And the plant is, on the face of it, poisonous. you know, which always surprises people. But as a tiny subset molecule, in the right dosage, it can be a tremendously beneficial molecule. And this is, you know, it's the sort of thing we should contrast with other natural things like nutmeg, menthol, alcohol. There are lots of products around us in everyday life. And if you take them in too high a dose, you will certainly feel the negative consequences. People don't ordinarily identify that with something like nutmeg, but, you know, take 15 servings of nutmeg and you will know about it. It's remarkable. Anyway, so oleandrin is a tiny molecule within the plant Nerium oleander. The best way to think about this, you know, we certainly wouldn't advise anyone to go out there chomping leaves of oleander plants. That wouldn't end well. The way to think about this is as follows. Think about a barrel of crude oil. You can't run your car safely or effectively on a barrel of crude oil. But if you have the knowledge, expertise, the resources, the technology to be able to separate and isolate a tiny fraction from that barrel of oil called gasoline, you can safely and effectively run your car on that. So oleandrin is effectively a tiny fraction within that Nerium oleander plant, but you need the expertise and to be able to very precisely isolate that molecule from within the plant in order to be able to use it.
Okay, so talk about the using it, because that's really what we want to get to, is what is it effective once in the right form and the right dosage in doing?
Sure. So this work was originally carried out because the molecule has important properties in the treatment of cancer. So these are oncology applications, in a range of different cancers, and it's shown significant promise in that regard. As with so many of these stories, there was a serendipitous discovery that it had important antiviral properties. And the compound has the ability to significantly reduce the infectivity of certain viruses. One of the classes of viruses it's particularly useful for are what are called envelope viruses. So this is where you've got an RNA strand with a glycoprotein wrapper. In the presence of the compound, the virus seems to have difficulty creating a complete viral envelope. So we've done a bunch of different research with some very prestigious institutions that have shown us that after the presence of our compound, there is a missing element in the glycoprotein wrapper of some of these viruses. There is also a precipitous drop in the viral infectivity of those viruses. Now, we believe there might be some other elements at work as well as a result of the presence of our compound, but that's certainly one of our hypotheses about how this works. Nevertheless, the point, Frank, is that in vitro studies, we have seen remarkable performance against viruses, and in particular, COVID-19.
So this is where we're going to pick up on the other side of a short break with Andrew Whitney, the executive chairman of Phoenix Biotechnology, a company that is bringing to bear possibly a cure for COVID-19 and the end of this national nightmare through which we have all been suffering. We'll talk more about how it could perhaps transform not just this public health crisis, but perhaps get America back for all of us with Andrew on the other side of this break. Stay tuned.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are visiting with a good friend, Andrew Whitney, the executive chairman of Phoenix Biotechnology, and we're discussing both the remarkable and seemingly very promising treatment for COVID-19 that his company has developed and has subjected to some important experimentation and study and trials and so on. And we're going to talk a little bit now about how the thing works and how effective it actually is, and then why, in the face of all of that, it's being subjected to such intense criticism. So what exactly is the mechanism by which this oleandrin compound seemingly operates against, COVID-19, the CCP virus, among other things?
Well, Frank, we've got 25 years of research into this molecule. we probably know more about it than anyone else on the planet at this point. It is quite an obscure molecule. However, in the course of that research, which again has been done by a phenomenally talented team that works for the company, we have made certain important discoveries about what this molecule does within cells and to viruses, for example. A virus, as you probably know, is an RNA strand, or one class of viruses are called envelope viruses. They're an RNA strand with a glycoprotein wrapper. And think of it like a Snickers bar where you've got a wrapper around the outside of it, if you will. That glycoprotein wrapper is extremely important in terms of the functionality of the virus. What we discovered in important work with the likes of MD Anderson is that when our compound is present, that viral envelope is incomplete. So we have a theory that obviously there's a link between those two things, and it turns out this is applicable across a whole range of different envelope viruses, of which COVID-19 coronavirus, the generic, is one. It's an envelope virus. So to cut a long story sideways, we went to the University of Texas Medical Branch at Galveston. They are the World Reference Center for arboviruses and infectious diseases. They were the first in the United States to sequence the COVID-19 virus. And they've actually, I believe, tested 53,000 compounds in the course of their research during this pandemic against COVID-19. Ours is one of those compounds. The UTMB guys have done incredible work with this. We are tremendously glad of their involvement on this particular topic. And in a whole slew of their experiments, they found an average 20,000-fold reduction in viral infectivity in the presence of our compound. So that's not 20,000%, that's 20,000 times. That's a precipitous decline in viral infectivity. Now, I must emphasize that kind of laboratory performance, it doesn't mean you can run screaming into the street shouting Eureka. That is a laboratory phenomenon. However, we've also got some very, very interesting anecdotal data in humans that's been shared with the FDA now. We have animal tests underway. And the other thing I would bring you back to is the fact that because of the work on cancer, we've already taken this through phase 1 and 2 clinical trials. So per the FDA standard, human safety and an approximate dosage has already been established.
That's hugely important, obviously. Yeah.
Right. So exactly. So what I'm telling you is we've got something that we know is safe per the FDA standard, which has very, very promising signs in terms of efficacy in a laboratory environment. We also have important anecdotal data, and we've now got animal studies and underway as well. So all of those things, we believe create a pretty compelling picture. And we think we can bring something very, very important to the mix here, which right now we can create in very significant scale right this minute.
So, Andrew Whitney, we're talking about a potential cure for this disease. And what needs to be done to validate that it is that? And what's the impediment to achieving whatever is needed now?
What we need more than anything else, Frank, is the ability to conduct hospital tests in a supervised environment. And we have plenty of hospitals that want to work with us on this because they know what it is. They've looked at some of our early findings. They find it compelling and they want to go ahead with hospital trials. They can't do that without the FDA say so. And we need something from the FDA called an IND number or emergency use authorization. So we've been going through months of process here. We really got into this in April, working through the official pathways. It's been many months now. You know, I recognize that the system's obviously got a tremendous amount to cope with at the moment. But the thing that just plagues us all is the death toll this virus is having. And in the last 2 months alone, enough Americans have died of this virus that you could overfill Madison Square Gardens. And that's just, it's an atrocity. And we believe we have something which is safe and efficacious and ready to go. So all we're asking for is the opportunity to try that, and we don't see what the downside is.
So the trials in hospitals would be one thing, and you need FDA approval for that. The other possibility is that this is a natural supplement, and it could be marketed as such without any claims that it, you know, cures COVID-19 or cancer or anything else, but nonetheless could be made available to the public, as you say, now in large quantities. And what is the impediment to doing that, Andrew Whitney?
So dietary supplements and nutraceuticals, as you know, Frank, are not regulated by the FDA. That's why if you look on the back of them, they say this is not an FDA-regulated product. So if you think about essential oils and echinacea and things like that, they fall outside of the FDA's remit. But there is something called the dietary list, which the FDA maintains. So you can think of that as kind of like the approved set of Lego bricks that you can build something from. And there's obviously validity to that, because you can't just have people whipping up obscure cocktails of you know, cyanide and arsenic in their basement and deciding to launch that on an unsuspecting market as a dietary supplement so they don't have to go through any scrutiny. There's a logic for that type of process. However, our point would be, we already know that this is safe. It's been established as safe. It's also something that has been, you know, everywhere around the world has been used since the Mesopotamian as a diet supplement. So this is not news.
You've established a dosage that is both safe and potentially game-changing in terms of this disease. Andrew, I don't know that it needs to be belabored, but obviously if there is a cure for COVID-19, this would have transformative effects on our situation, but the public health piece of it, obviously, but our economy, and as I said earlier, the national condition, which has national security implications as well. This is one of the reasons why I've been so excited about this product and the possibility that it will be brought to bear. And yet, what we're now hearing from quite a number of sources, many of them in the left-wing press, some of them citing government officials, usually unnamed, some of them referring to academics or other so-called experts who have expressed very strong concern about, misgivings, or downright opposition to what you're doing, the cumulative effect of which has been to really trash what you're doing, notably with our mutual friend Mike Lindell on Anderson Cooper's show. Having been trashed myself by Anderson Cooper, I can feel his pain. But this effect has been to signal to a lot of Americans who haven't ever heard of this product before that there are serious problems with it. Talk us through what's going on. Why are you getting this kind of flack? It certainly suggests you're over the target, but what else is afoot as you see it?
It's very interesting, Frank. Certainly the Anderson Cooper interview with Mike Lindell was an extreme example. I think in that particular case, Anderson Cooper was pressing on Mike about matters of science and technology. That's clearly not Mike's bailiwick. He's a phenomenal businessman, arguably one of the greatest marketeers, businessmen, and scale experts in this country. So, but he's not a physician. He's not a scientist. He doesn't pretend to be either. So I think it was highly, highly unfair to go after it in that manner. But in any case, you know, with a modicum of research, Anderson Cooper could have found research papers online that document all this. We've got more than 20 studies out there that talk about the clinical trials, phase 1 and 2 on oleandrin in humans, and then also the efficacy of oleandrin in a whole host of different situations and different very prestigious institutions. So as to the question of, you know, why the negative media onslaught, it beats me, Frank. I mean, it really feels like cure canceling. Here we are. We're just saying, look, we're all in this together, guys. We don't want to politicize it. Just all sick of being stuck indoors and told we've got to put a mask on to go and get a bottle of orange juice from the grocery store. So we're all in this together. We just want a cure. Everybody wants to go back to whatever they were doing beforehand. But families are getting ruined. Businesses are getting ruined, communities are getting ruined, and the country is just being cast asunder because we haven't beaten this thing yet. And what we're sitting there saying is, look, we have what we believe is a potential solution. We know it's safe in humans. We've already done FDA phase 1 and 2 safety. That's the FDA standard for safety, same molecule. We also have great indications of efficacy, lab-based data from tremendous people like the guys at UTMB. We have very interesting anecdotal data that's been provided to the FDA in humans. We've got animal tests going on, again, very promising. what we're saying is, let's have an opportunity to test it. What would be wrong with that? There's nothing, it's not going to poison anybody because we already know it's safe. So what would be wrong with letting us just test it would be my point. But instead, we're being subjected to a whole bunch of invective, almost along the lines of what gives you the right to say this, or what gives you the right to have a cure. And it's absurd. You know, we're not claiming, hey, Eureka, we've solved it all. But we're saying, look, call our bluff, give us a test.
I also want to just say, I believe that those who are standing in the way of this, not all of them maybe, but some of them for sure, are hoping that there will not be a cure for COVID-19 until November 4th. And that is wrong. That is reprehensible. It is, I believe, actually treasonous, because the country is on the line. And we need, if there is a cure here, to validate that as quickly as humanly possible. And I hope the FDA, as well as the White House and others, will be listening to this very important conversation. Andrew Whitney, again, thank you for having it with us. Please keep coming back to us with updates on this. It couldn't be more important, and we couldn't be more appreciative of your work. Next up, we'll speak with Brigadier General Roy Robison. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It is a special privilege, as well as distinct pleasure, to say we are joined by a retired military officer of considerable renown, who is these days continuing to render important service to his country as the president of a very, very consequential organization. It is the National Guard Association of the United States. It is basically in the business of speaking for men and women in uniform who, by and large, can't speak for themselves. But his own time in service in uniform of the Army National Guard for some 33 years is now serving as the foundation for his leadership of this organization. We're speaking, of course, of Brigadier General Roy Robison, United States Army National Guard, retired. And General Robinson, I am so pleased to have you with us for the first time. Congratulations on the role that you are in now. And I'm very pleased to be able to say the service of the National Guard is at the moment perhaps as important as at any time in our history, both for what it's doing in support of oftentimes combat operations overseas, but also for what it's doing to secure us here at home. So thank you, sir, for your past service and that you're rendering these days.
Frank, I can't thank you enough for having me on. There's nothing like being able to tell the National Guard story, and it's a great story right now. The National Guard Association here in D.C., we have about 45,000 members. We represent about 450,000 soldiers and airmen that are standing in National Guard formations throughout the 54 states, territories, and the District of Columbia. And I have to say, right now, with everything that the Guard's being asked to do, I think the visibility of the National Guard out in those states and territories and in the communities that they live in is probably as high now as it's ever been. And we want to continue to do all the things that we need to do to support the nation.
General, one of the things that's going on, of course, in the country at the moment is a lot of what has been described as civil disturbances. I kind of think of it as revolutionary mayhem myself, but whatever one calls it, at the direction of the governors in several of the states, your team has been called in to try to help maintain or restore, in some cases, order. Talk a little bit about that mission, how it's going as you see it, and the stresses that it is imposing on the troops.
You know, that's really a great question. Time's great. The civil unrest, responding to civil unrest, is not actually new to the National Guard. There are some uniqueness to the way that we're able to, the way that the National Guard is chartered, the way that we were formed, and our ability to respond to some of these issues. One really unique thing about the National Guard is, you know, they are citizen soldiers. They are citizens first, and then when they're called to duty, then they put the uniform on and they serve as a soldier or an airman. In their citizen role, they live in these communities. They live in these cities. They live in these small towns. They live in these urban areas. some of which have been affected by some of the civil unrest that we've seen. But this is their home, and they want to go out and they want to provide the assistance that we provide as a way, another way of giving back and protecting the communities in which they live. If you think about it, that's truly the only organization in the world that exists like that. And they are uniquely postured to help, to be in a supporting role at the call of the governor to go out and address some of these issues. And they've done it in a magnificent way. I'm not saying that being called out to respond to civil unrest is necessarily the favorite mission tasking that the soldiers and airmen are asked to do, because it's difficult. And they want to make sure they're there to protect the citizens and make sure they have the right to assemble and protest as much as they are to protect the infrastructure and the other citizens and the businesses who are not involved in the unrest. So, yeah, I think it's a challenge, but it's something that the National Guard has been doing for a long time.
Yeah, it's a challenge. Well, I guess what I sense is perhaps a little bit different is the magnitude of this challenge at the moment and some of the motivations behind it. I mean, this is not just, peaceful protesters, alas, or people who have perhaps a very specific narrow grievance, but a much more ambitious and widespread and ominous project on the part of some of the radicals who are in the streets at the moment. Let's talk a little bit about one other facet of what you're up against, and that is, of course, the, well, lingering effects of the coronavirus. I think of it as the Chinese Communist Party virus myself, but whatever one calls it, General Robinson. First of all, how much have the Guard units around the country been themselves affected by COVID-19? And how are they performing their missions in the face of it in support of, the authorities who are trying to maintain public health as well as public safety?
Like every other organization out there, the National Guard has been dramatically affected by COVID-19 and the way that we train and the way that we prepare for mission sets. We've been limited in our ability to do some of that. But I'll tell you, we've also been, and I couldn't be prouder of the men and women who have been responding at the call of the governor in each of the states and territories to go out and be a part of the overall response to COVID-19. They've literally been on front lines with doctors and nurses and other first responders. If you're talking about testing capabilities, if you're talking about the actual testing sites, distribution of food, all the things that they do to make sure that the communities, as they deal with this COVID-19, are able to continue to do the things that they normally do in supporting the citizens. You know, I think we're down probably to about 21,000 that continue to be involved in the COVID-19 response. And keep in mind, that's not all in a federal status. Some of those may be in a state active duty status, and the bulk of them won't be in a federal status. You probably heard in the news where the administration has cut the reimbursement from 100% federal to 75%, 25%, where the state pays the 25% of the response. It's being managed. Most of those soldiers and airmen are continuing to serve in a federal status in spite of the 25% that's being borne by the states who ask for the assistance. We've seen those numbers fluctuate greatly. They've been as high as 50,000 in terms of the numbers of soldiers who were specifically responding to COVID-19 requirements. But I got to tell you, the citizens who are out there throughout the country who have seen these soldiers and airmen pull up in their Humvees all over the world as this COVID-19 thing has kind of hit a crescendo. They, again, like every other response, they bring calm to a chaotic environment. They are at the direction of the federal authorities on what they establish and what they do. They're actually being controlled at the state level by the governor, who probably understands better than anybody else in the country what the unique requirements are for each of the states. So I don't know of any other organization where they're called out like that.
Yeah, no, and do it so well in addition. General, quickly and just in closing, what do the Guard need in order to perform these missions successfully in the future? Is it more and better quality equipment? Is it medical coverage? Is it pay incentives? I mean, what are the sorts of things, as you're looking at it, that are needed to maintain the morale as well as the readiness and mission performance of your troops?
The Guard gets great response from the Congress, and they're the ones that actually see to the equipping portion. We encourage them to continue to validate that those equipment requirements are being done with new and improved equipment as it becomes available. The services, both the Air Force and the Army, participate in that. But I tell you, the thing that's really kind of come to the surface during this COVID-19 response is healthcare. So there are soldiers and airmen on the front end of this thing that were mobilized either in a state active duty status where they weren't provided health care, or in a federal status where they were on an order less than 31 days where they didn't qualify for TRICARE health care. And there's some unique intricacies about the status and what they are able to, what they are awarded by the federal government in that response. If a soldier is deployed overseas and they go to the war fight and they go over there and participate and they come back and they demo here in the States, they are automatically given 6 months of continuous medical coverage at the end of that mobilization. You can take that same soldier or airman, you can put them on orders for 6 months, 9 months, 10 months, whatever the case may be here in the continental U.S. in a domestic response like COVID-19, and when they come off of mobilization, they don't receive that 6 months. We literally expose them to COVID-19 on almost a routine basis. And when they come off of that mob order, they don't get the benefit of a program called TAMP, T-A-M-P, which would allow for the service member and their family to have additional medical coverage for 6 months after mobilization.
That sure sounds like something that needs to be fixed. I remember in my youth, I worked on the Senate Armed Services Committee, and a very prominent fixture on that committee at the time was another Southern former military officer, as a matter of fact, Strom Thurmond. And he had a wonderful expression, which he would trot out with regularity. He said, "The God needs it." And by and large, the God got it when he said that. So I trust that while he's long gone, of course, there are others in the United States Congress who will be very much resonant to this appeal, and we'll be sure to make certain they get it. Thank you so much, General Overson. It's great to talk with you and to have a chance to hear about your own insights into the challenges facing the National Guard today. And we, again, appreciate your great leadership at the National Guard Association of the United States. Keep it up. Come back to us again, sir, with updates, if you would. Next up, we'll speak with J.R. Nyquist about the challenges we're facing from enemies foreign and domestic. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's time for, well, what I consider to be one of the real high points of this program, and that is our weekly visit with J.R. Nyquist, known to his friends as Jeff, a remarkable resource on, well, the whole host of matters that involve national security, as well as the common weal, if you will, the condition of our republic and the threats thereto. He is the author of three terrific books that I know of: Oranges of the Fourth World War, The New Tactics of Global War, and most recently, The Fool and His Enemy. Jeff can be found at his own blog, which is jrnyquist.blog, as well as in numerous other outlets and publications, including the fabulous Epoch Times. Jeff Nyquist, it's good to have you back. Welcome. I wanted to visit with you about two things that you've posted recently at your blog, Jeff, that really do speak to the condition of our country and threats that I guess I would characterize as enemies domestic and foreign. Let's start with the domestic. In a piece describing cultural subversion and socialist dictatorship, you've gotten into, you know,
the nature of the Marxist revolution that we're confronting as it's been seen elsewhere and it's operating here. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Yeah, I'd gotten hold of a copy of the KGB, history of the KGB that they wrote themselves in 1977, an English translation. And I was amazed at the section about how they guided Soviet citizens prophylactically away from the wrong ideas, that it would really be a serious matter if they were called in to have a talk with the KGB to get them on the right path.
Wrong ideas and the right path, of course, being euphemisms for the dictates of the party. In that case, the Soviet Communist Party, right?
Yeah, and of course, what you realize is that with Antonio Gramsci was a Marxist theorist. He was Italian, and he was put in jail in Mussolini's Italy. But he wrote these prison notebooks, and he had an enormous theoretical influence. And Karl Boggs's book on Gramsci's Marxism points out all the mechanisms that the Marxists grabbed. The communists said, "Hey, this is very useful because the idea is, how do we get control over society where we don't control the police, where we don't control the state? How can we do it? We can do it culturally, and we can prepare the revolution." And, of course, Gramsci's thing is revolution will be less violent, supposedly, if they're already communist by the time we have the revolution.
And the march through the institutions, with which his name is always linked, is a means of accomplishing that sort of cultural transformation of the proletariat or the elite, for that matter, right?
Yeah, and of course, the way that they control people then is they develop these narratives like feminism, like anti-racism, like global warming, that if you disagree, and they're basically, these things are used as justifications for socialism, for changing the system, for radical change. And if you're in an academic setting or a professional setting, It's woven into the professional training in many areas in our society. And if you disagree with it, you're going to be penalized in your career very subtly. You might not get that promotion or that job. And everybody kind of knows it. And it's not like the KGB is going to come and arrest you or you're going to be thrown in a gulag or a re-education camp. It's much more subtle than that. It's like you might not get that extra, that raise or that promotion or whatever. And it has this very poisonous effect in moving society to the left.
But there is always hanging over it the prospect that you might wind up in the gulag, isn't there? There is that sort of ultimate threat of force, especially as the party becomes, ensconced in power.
Yes, and of course we're seeing that now with the people getting on their knees. You know, the Americans getting on their knees are actually physically afraid because now there's Marxist mobs running around. And it's very threatening when angry people show up and you have to. And when you're bending the knee to Black Lives Matter or Antifa, you're really bending the knee to Marxism, to Marxist ideology, because these narratives were created by Marxists to take over the society.
And they are Marxist groups, in fact, that are at work here. And Jeff, I mean, the point about taking a knee is something you've written about also, and I think this is so important for us to understand. That is an act of submission, and it only can have the effect of emboldening the enemy, assuring them that they are going to win, which, of course, inevitably translates into even more violence or oppressive behavior or totalitarianism, ultimately, does it not? I want to ask you about specifically one other manifestation of this same basic phenomenon, Jeff, and that is perhaps the most dangerous totalitarian regime history has ever known, namely that of the Chinese Communist Party in China. Another of your blog posts at jrnyquist.blog talks about a propaganda film, I guess you might call it, produced by the People's Liberation Army, which has this phrase in it that you've noted is repeated, actually. Peace behind me, war in front of me. Tell us about that.
Yes, it's repeated twice, and it's sort of a very slick advertisement for the People's Liberation Army. That's the Chinese military. And at the beginning, you know, you see a man saying goodbye to his sweetheart, saying goodbye to his son. He's going off to war, basically. I am a Chinese soldier, And he's now you're seeing the tanks and the helicopter gunships and the fighter planes getting ready. And then the next thing is he's going off. You're hearing this peace behind me, war in front of me, repeated twice. And the impression is very strongly given that the country is going to war. And I take up my steel rifle. The war proves a man's character. Things of this nature. It is not a recruitment poster for peace. It's not even a recruitment poster, really. It's a sort of subtle signaling to the population that war is coming, which, by the way, those signals have been being given out very strongly since around March and in the Chinese media, and especially in the military media, where this kind of message has been just about overt, in which they've even pulled out old essays by Chairman Mao about how war is inevitable. And this is the thing, if you go back to the communist literature, they say the final phase of destroying capitalism has to be violent.
And Jeff, the call that you've just described, essentially for not just the People's Liberation Army, but through various other means, the people of China themselves to prepare for war, raises, of course, the question, war with whom? And I know you've given a lot of thought to this. The obvious candidates are those in closest proximity to China, notably Taiwan, perhaps Japan, maybe even, further afield, the Philippines. But I think you're of the view, and I'd like you just to share quickly with our audience why, the Chinese may have us in their crosshairs, not just these neighbors and allies of ours in the Western Pacific.
Yeah, the Chinese are really good strategists. And if you look at it, any which way you look at it, if China picks a fight with India or Taiwan, Japan or the Philippines, they're going to end up in a war with us. And really, if you look at the pattern of Chinese strategy, they're trying to intimidate those countries. You know, the drumbeat for years to Australia is, you better detach yourself from the United States and attach yourselves to us, because we're the future, not the Americans. So they're trying to isolate us. And they're trying to do the same thing economically through their policies in Europe and Africa and Asia. They're trying to cut us off from raw materials and resources. They're trying to control major choke points going into oceans. They want to control the South China Sea, over which, trillions of dollars of trade pass. There's a very fascinating, besides being just sensible, there's a speech by a former defense minister, Chiao Chen, about 18 years ago, in which he basically says, we're going to make them believe that we are going to attack Taiwan, but we are coming after America. And he says, then we're not just coming after aircraft carriers and satellites. And that is a very striking statement.
Meaning they're coming for us here at home as well. Jeff Nyquist, I appreciate, as always, your great work at jrnyquist.blog. I encourage everyone to make this required reading each day, as I try to. And, of course, for your visits with us here, as well as your new book, The Fool and His Enemy. Thanks so much for joining us, and come back to us again soon, if you would, Jeff. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.